position number 23175, reel 5.
Mr. Hastings, reel 5. You were describing the difficulty you had with the generator.
Yes. Right, well, I'd learned it in theory, and I went right for what I'd learned. And I decided to do that. It was getting a weak mixture where I worked it out, by the modern-day standards, modern fuels and what have you. And I corrected it, as I write, and it worked, champion. That was it. And then they took the diesel one off me, the more one one, gave it to another man who probably hadn't as much knowledge of the engines as I had, being top marks on that. Of course, I'd had it open gate before that Gisbetter. So, next thing I know, the sergeant says, you're on a charge, I've got to take you to Central Camp. On a charge, he says, yes, for a dirty engine. A dirty engine? Well, you mean the one they took off with the list? He said, yes. They took me into Central Camp, they'd go in front of the OSA. And the bloke, there's other people who joined the regiment, some were conscripts, or just before the war, like, from other places on the air, like probably where you live and all that, or the same area. And this was a score beyond this. And I said, well, went in, like, and he'd been put on a charge for not cleaning the engine. And they blamed it on me. That's the courage we got the engine in. So I said to his detachment commander, his sergeant, I said, well, what do you mean? It was clean the engine. He took it off me. Oh, he said, you didn't clean the brass pipes and the copper pipes on it with metal polish. I said, there's a warning, you don't do that. Copper pipes, I says. Oil pressure goes in them. Copper's soft, there's flaws in copper. I said, when you clean your buttons, I said, it wears them down, smooths them off. That's like acid. I said, if there's a flaw in that copper, that could weaken it even further. Oil's under pressure. It got a leak. The engine's going to seize up. He said, well, it should be cleaned then. Oh, I said, I'm sorry about that. I said, but I never cleaned that. The engine was clean otherwise. So when I went in front of the OC, like, it was read out, it was all that gone. And I explained it to the OC, I said, I'm to blame for that, not him. Because he's detachment commander. And he was very annoyed about this, luckily. But that's the army as regards being strict in that. Bull, they call it, don't they? So I said, well, look, sir, I said, it's my fault. And I explained to the OC, I said, why I didn't clean it. I said, there's a warning, don't clean them. The engine was clean otherwise, well wiped down. And the sergeant in charge of MT, he used to lecture at the college in Hartlepool here. He gave me a good name in front of the OC. He said, we never have any bother with this man, never have to go out to him. Well, I just did the job and I was taught to do it. I said, so that's it. When I come out, they'd have to give us a sentence then. So I said to the major before I come out, well, I said, we're in the army, sir. I said, discipline must be maintained. I understand that leg, and this thing's got to be dealt with by you. Fair enough, I said.
You said that at one point you were taken to learn to drive, a driving course.
Yeah.
What happened to you on that? What vehicles were you learning on?
I learned on petrol engines and diesel engines. I had to give one that had been through the course, there was quite a few of us on the Duton Gate. I had to give a lecture on a certain part of the engine. And we didn't pick our own. I was picked the single-plated corn clutch, they call it. I remember that. And I had to give a lecture on how it worked. I gave a lecture on how it worked. And when I finished it, they said, yes, that's very good, that's right. I said, I don't understand it. You don't understand it, the instructor said. You've just given it out. I said, I know. But I said, these two plates come together. Isn't it a cam or something? It goes in and doings to lock it so it doesn't slip. No, I said, you mean them two plates come together with the line, like a brake line, and that drives the car? He said, yes, doesn't it slip? No, he said. Oh, well, I said, understand it. No, I thought someone went in and locked it later on. You've got it right, he says.
Was the course driving and maintaining?
No, this was just maintaining and a bit of driving, not a lot of driving. Later I went to one of Duton Gate, not Luton Gate, Diebold camp, and there we were throwing guns out, getting them out the mud and that, and getting ourselves out of the matadors with a winch on. You had to put ground anchors in like that, cross them like that. And you would be this side of them, and you fasten your winch up to it, you burn the winch up, and you pull yourself out of the guns. Or with a gun out and got stuck there, you get yourself out, then you pull the gun out the same way. Like
this was, as you say, later on.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm.
What was the state of the unit for in relation to what kind of vehicles did you have at the time the war started?
The only military vehicles we had was the Thornycroft, with that generator inside, that two engines in, one for driving the corners, another one for driving the generator. And the others on, they just took flat-top lorries for transferring gear about and troops and what have you. We were short of transport then,
taken over from civilian.
That's right, taken over from civilians, first in the military service, yeah.
How long did it take before our army equipment started to come through?
That I can't remember. When I got moved out of there later on, then they started coming out, 1941, if I can remember, after Dunkirk. Because what they did get in there went overseas before Dunkirk, and it was left there, as you know. And by the way, there, Dunkirk, that's what started a 16 tax system for looking after the lorries. They lost a lot of transport. They didn't know how to maintain it, you see. And the 16 tax. One task, number one, you had to sign a book, you checked that part of the engine. And you went through at 16. You went over and over again. They called it the 412, you called it there. That's what I had that case in. And you had to be... They'd be checked every now and then with the officer. Once a month, you had to check another one called 406. Once a month, the officer would check and make sure you'd done all your maintenance and that. That was a good thing. Dunkirk brought that on. That's for the likes of me, learn more about engines, you see. Put to good use later on.
In addition to working the generator, what other duties did you have whilst you were on the moors in the early days?
Well, that's about all. Sometimes you go for a route march, and that's about all, yeah.
When did you leave the unit?
When did what?
When did you leave the searchlight unit? Was it still a searchlight unit when
you
left
it? It was still a searchlight. No, when I left the searchlight unit, they brought us into Scarby Hall. We were there for a few weeks. And then I left them. There was four of us left. We got posted up to Fort William in Scotland. And I don't know where the others went.
What time would this be? What? Do you remember the date?
This was at the back end of the year.
And the year was? What year was it?
41. Because when I got there, they'd all been on leave or something, and the First Army, it went out. And I had to go with the rear party for the rest of the transport, where they drive the matadors and that right down from Fort William down to Cardiff and Wales to put onto a cargo ship.
At the moment, I wanted to establish you were on the searchlights for a given period of time, and then you left them. You left them and went to Scorby Hall, did you say? Was that your first move from the searchlights?
When I was on the searchlight, I was sitting with them at Scorby Hall. And then they shifted me out. I shipped me out to Diebold camp. And Diebold camp was posted to another Hartlepool regiment down the south, in Northfleet or something, the 220 battery. The sergeant major was called Blackett, I remember that. When he was at the station where we got off the trail leg.
Diebold camp, what were you doing there?
Diebold camp, we were learning to drive the lorries and that.
This is the heavy stuff you were
heavy
talking
stuff,
about.
Heavy stuff, yes, right. We used to go convoys down to York and back on the one with three tunnels and that, and drive other things on the torn guns and what have you, heavy stuff.
So after leaving the searchlights, you went to Diebold camp for this lorry driving.
Yeah.
And then when you'd completed that training, then you say you moved down the south.
Yes,
you?
I went down with a static site down the south there. There's no static site, 3.7s. Then we shipped it to...
Do you remember the name of the unit? I think you gave it 220.
220, yeah. And then we were shifted up to Leeds.
What were you doing in Kent? What was happening to you down there?
On this
other gun site you talk about in the south of England.
In Cobham it was, aye. Well, we were just on, fatigues and that. There was no lorry for us to drive. But they only had one lorry. to drive, and some of those ordinary to drive then when we went, you see. We were just helping out in the guns and that, manning the guns with the other's legs, gun drill and that. And
were these anti-aircraft guns?
Yeah, 3.7s, yeah.
And you were training on them, as you say?
We trained on them, yeah. We mucked in with them, like. And I just did fatigues, and that was it, to pass the time away. It was quiet after that, because the Battle of Britain had been fought then. Yeah.
Oh, you weren't engaged with heavy enemy activity at the
time? No.
Do you recall
that? I can't remember air raids taking place when we got down there. Yeah.
Can you describe the 3.7 gun?
3.7 gun, yes. It's the equivalent to the 88 gun the Germans have. The Germans are a bit superior to ours, but the same size and what have you. It was a gun, aircraft gun, and we used it as an anti-tank gun in North Africa later on. Longstop Island in place in North Africa, where the campaign ended there.
What size shell, for example, did it fire?
This 3.7. I forget the poundage of the shell, like the weight of it.
And the crew, how many crew?
They about eight, probably. That's sound locators and things like that. And that's when the air test used to man some of this gear as well, the sound equipment and that, yeah.
They were with you at that time.
Yeah.
Can you explain the different responsibilities of the crew, of the each member of the crew, on the gun?
Well, we had some set the gun. If you use it as a field gun, you had to have a dial sight on it. And they called the lay of the gun. And you had to have an angle that and spirit levels and all that. Others sometimes loaded the gun, others fired the gun. And there's other people stood at the back, about two or three of us. They used to come over the shells and put the shells in, and someone would shoot the breech and all that. It was like a proper teamwork. Each one had to do something. It all worked in as a team, as a part of a machine.
Who commanded each gun?
The gun position officer, the GPO, as they called them.
And how many guns would there be in a battery?
Four.
And one officer commanding four, or one officer on each gun?
One officer is a command four. Sometimes there might be two, it all depends whether we're laid out, that you say. Sometimes there were four. If they were like a field gun, they took the as a field gun to fire tanks direct, an anti-tank. Well, we get probably four together. Sometimes you're singing out single, like. When I was the last regiment I was anti-tank regiment, I went as a tank driver. All the tanks were manned, like, if someone caught it, like, had to take over the tank. We never got to that. They gave me the jeep to drive, the troop officer. And what we used to do, we had one tank in our troop, or one M10. And I used to drive him up to the front, the forward position. We'd take it with us. And so far up it, we'd find a hiding place for the hull down, as they called it, or behind a farmhouse or something, or an air stack. So it didn't come to observation by the Germans and that. And they would leave it there. I'd go up with him. He'd consult their forward positions and that, and his strong points, and send me back for the tank. Now, I had to tell the tank which way did they go, and if I stopped, there's open ground, he caught up with us, we'd both go together, because the certain parts were under enemy observation. You had to be careful, so we just could press an open gap like that, and the shells would start landing, you see. We're taught all that.
We'll come to that, of course. Yeah. I want to concentrate at the moment on this new situation that you were in, and the anti-aircraft role.
Yeah.
How long were you there? With that particular battery.
Well, that particular battery, I was with that when the war finished.
In England, in Kent.
No, this is North Africa.
No, I'm talking about Kent.
Italy.
We're jumping a long way forward.
Oh, see.
Kent, how long were you with that?
In North Africa, that would be.
When you went down, when you left the searchlights and Deer Bolt Camp, you went down to Cobalt in Kent, was it?
Yes, that's right.
And how long were you with that unit?
I was with them about 6.5 months, as far as I can remember.
And that, as you say, was basically training with the gun and doing fatigues.
That's so, yeah.
As there was no action.
No action.
Did you see any of the results of any air action that had gone before you arrived? Was the area destroyed, or was there any sign of that?
No, not. I've seen in my own town, I come and leave, I've seen damage there. But when we're in the Yorkshire Moors out like that, well, they didn't come to bomb us on the middle of the moors. There's nothing there worthwhile, was there? It was the cities that go down, the ICR and things like that.
So you were there about 6-9 months, as you're saying. Where did you go after that, from that unit?
From that unit, let's say now. From the Yorkshire Moors, you mean?
No, you moved from the Yorkshire Moors, you said. Then you'd gone to Dearboat and you were working with the heavier traffic.
Oh, that's right. From there,
then you went down to Kent.
They were told to hand over to somebody else. And the whole lot, regiment, personnel, only moved up to Leeds for a refit and everything like that. Got Tommy guns and all that, getting ready to go overseas, I imagine. And the four were singled out and were sent us up to Fort William. And that's when I joined the First Army. I followed the rear guard out there with them.
What was the unit you were joining at Fort William? What did it have a name and number?
Yeah, well, I forget what it was now. I've been in 4 years, say. It's a long time ago. When I left the army, got the mother, I just forgot about it more or less.
So what were you doing then at Fort William?
I was just an MT again. It was on my record, you say, yeah. Driving, yeah.
So you're a fully-fledged driver by now?
Yes, fully-fledged driver. My record say that, yeah.
And what were you driving? What vehicle or vehicles?
Well, I was driving anything. Matadors, the 3.7 gun on the back at times. They were all like a static site around the advanced aerodrome, ground defence for that leg, and I was driving the 3-ton trucks, sometimes taking rations out of all the other things I was collecting in the LA. Sometimes I'd be driving a utility truck, as they called it, in that regiment, and eventually, after the war finished out there, well, I got yellow jaundice and was whitelisted.
You can't remember the name and number of the regiment that you had been transferred to?
No, I can't.
It's okay. Mm. How long were you there? Because this was now 1942.
It was. I was there till about back in the 1942. The 43 as well. I think I left then. We're in Africa then, 43.
In
the war finished out there.
The First Army went in November 42, didn't they? They invaded North Africa. So you were in that, were you? You were in that invasion.
I wasn't in the invasion. I was the rear part of it. We landed at Bougie, not Algiers, anything like that.
But the others had gone in by then.
They'd gone in, yes, where they rest the transport up to them and all that, in advanced positions. Then we started, we were there.
Do you recall where you sailed from to go to North Africa?
We sailed from Cardiff, an ordinary tramp steamer. They called it the SS Thetis. I remember that because of the submarine before the war. Well, remember that. Submarine got lost off Liverpool or somewhere. A thetis as well.
So you didn't have your transport with you on the tramp steamer, did you?
Yes, it was on the fastened the hatches on the deck and all that. In fact, the ship rolled very badly. We weren't in hammocks. If you turn on your back when you're sleeping, the back on your side was all that badly at times. Yeah, the ship was top heavy with transport on the decks and that.
How did you feel about going abroad and into an action situation?
Oh, what?
How did you feel yourself? Or your own feelings?
Well, mixed feelings with. We were keen to go, but we weren't keen to go, you know, because you were going to war, and well, it's only obviously, isn't it? You know, would you come back again? I always had that feeling back in my mind, like. But on the whole, we just went with the crowd, and that was it. Discipline maintains, do as you're told, and that's it.
Do you remember the journey itself? Obviously, you've intimated it was a pretty rough one.
Ah, yes. I was 5 weeks on the boat. I was stationed on the end of the bridge on a twin Marlin machine gun, and I just come off watch from 12 o'clock in the afternoon to 4 o'clock come off watch. I was put my gear down below and the ship shook, and there was out of depth charge was the torpedo. We were in the Medi then, by the way, and I listened, oh, it's a depth charge. So I went up on deck, and the camera got up on deck there, I just got on deck to go to me, the gunner man-like. But I got our man stations there. And I seen the submarine, the U-boat in front of us. And one of our core vessels firing shells at the both of the corner tower. The deck was used to watch. And by the time I got up the ladder to where the gun got there, the time I got up there, looked over the bridge there, and it had gone. The next morning, the captain come round the skipper, like, and he says, the door be sunk to St. Peter. So they must have sunk them, like, 5 weeks on that ship I was.
And life on the ship itself, what was it like?
Well, I liked it. In fact, I volunteered to stop on it. Within the back, say, stop on it. There's no back towards the sea. I said, oh, but it's nice and clean here. When you get ashore, there'll be flies and all sorts of dust and that in the desert and that. That's what we go to on the desert if we get ashore. But they wouldn't let me. I had to go to the unit I was assigned to.
How, you know, what kind of role would you have had if you could have stopped on it? You weren't a sailor.
Well, I'd have stopped on it as manning armaments on the ship. Might have been a gun after end, you say, that gun's then astern, like.
Had you had leave before you'd gone abroad? Had you got home? Embarkation leave?
No, I didn't, but I took it. When the four of us got to Fort William, I went in front of the captain there, like the captain's, they're booked in, whatever, it's a norm, that, like. And I said to him, by the way, sir, when he'd finished telling us what was in for Stafford, like, I said, is there any chance of any leave, sir? He said, I'm sorry. He said, there's no leave now. And man, the way he was sorry, you could see it, the way he was doing. And he looked at me, you know. I thought he was trying to convey something to me. The four of us in there talking to him, when we come out, we're not getting any leave, Jim. I said, no. I said, what he's trying to tell us, because he made like a bit of a speech. And sorry, he said, my orders are this and that, like. And he outlined everything as far as he could go. I said, Santa, tell us, he can't give us any leave. He's more or less wanting us to take it. Because I said to him, it's only the case of seeing my family before I go, because I don't come back. And others agreed with us, like. Sorry, he said, man's a tired or something, can't leave you. Which was right. He had his orders. That's discipline in the services, after all. So I said, what are you going to do? I said, well, I'm going to go home for the weekend. So they get me free on Friday. On the Saturday morning, I'll get a platform ticket from Dumfries, because I won't have enough to get me home. And I'll get home, and I'll see my wife and family, and then the police will send us back, and that's it. Which that did happen, like. And
so you were married at this time?
Yes. I got married in 41 of that year, yeah. And I did go there. Two dropped out there, shied off. The other one, when he lived in the Midlands, he went, like. We found a company at Newcastle, and I went home. I got up at our station up here and walked down. Tom Kiss was waiting for me here, like. And I had 2 nights with the wife and seen my family. Police come to us one morning, I think it was. He stood by the door, like. I said, look, I'm going out there for the terrace house we lived in. I'm going out there. The toilet, I said. He's running away. I said, I won't run away. I said, might as well sit down. Well, I'll have my breakfast now. I said, you can have a couple with us. Like, to at the police station, and the superintendent charge the police station. He said, we often get people in, like, when I told him what it was all about. He said to the officer, he said, like, go home, bitch. He said, and get changed at the service. He said, this lad off the station, give me one, and off I went. And when I got to Dumfries Station, there was a escort waiting with a fixed beard. And there's quite a master sergeant was. So when he come up to us, are you Hastings? I said, yes, sergeant. Fall in, escort, fall in. Prisoner, no. I said, just a minute, I said, sergeant, I've come right from Hartlepool. If I'd wanted to take a powder, I'd have took it before then. I said, have you got any transport? I'm tired. He said, we've got a utility. He said, let's get in, I want to go to bed. When we went back, we seen an officer in the office next to a bit of an old country man or something we built it in. He said, all right, Hastings, see your family, all right. I said, oh, yes, sir, thank you, sir. He wasn't going to do anything about it. And this sergeant said, he said, shall I put him on a charge, sir? Yes. The officer wasn't doing it, he's a canny bloke. He's a gentleman. He used his brains, you know. I thought he'd be a good bloke to be in command. And this, not territorial, Bob, I thought.
So what was the punishment then?
7 days' pay, 2 days' royal warrant.
You didn't.
I didn't mind doing that. No, I
wouldn't. You weren't in the guard room, were you?
Oh no, I wasn't in the guard room. No.
And then after that, as you say, you moved off.
Moved the farm of the transport down there, drove it down there, like. And two stops we had taken, because when they drive there, they don't take it in a day, like. It might took us 2 days to get down there. Stop overnight at certain barracks, like, and a bit more, and they got to Cardiff, and then we spent the rest of the 2 weeks down there, just this time driving lorries under the nets on the quayside side to go into the ship. So I was doing all day there for about a week.
Must have been quite a sight on the dock sides at that time with all the...
Oh, yes. All the, you know, Billingham's laid out with little things. Well, all that was laid out like that in the outskirts of the town, like. And they were filled with army vehicles, tanks and that, ready to go to the ships, yeah. We're going there, dropping us off there, drive the vehicles on, like, and go back on with the lot. Mm.
Did the civilians in the area know what you were about, what was happening?
Well, it was obviously the way we'd go. We'd take the lorries under the ship and that, and tanks. They knew we were going overseas somewhere, like, and that was it. But the first time we had it in the papers by then, it wasn't in the papers that invaded, like. Just after that time we got there, it was in the papers.
Did you come across any Americans by this time?
Oh, yes. I looked at Americans at one place in Bizet after the fort finished. That's when they started calling Aussie bingo. They used to play in the Bovers gun pit they had. They used to play bingo with them, as they called it. And the Russians there got, you know, them carnation tins of carnation milk we get. Used to get about that big, like that, they were. That's sacks of stuff for the better than we had. Better equipment and everything, the Americans. They've got not the same, it's the same now, isn't it?
Did you get on with them all right?
Oh, yes.
No problems?
Yes. And when I was in the, before I got into with them, then while the war was still on there, at the advanced aerodrome, where the raft lived next door to us, we all our vehicle lads amongst the tents where the Spitfire pads are ours. And I got to know them. I got better food with the raft than I did with my own. I got chowed up once or twice for not having any cocos.
What are your memories of approaching the African coast and landing?
Well, we come in the dark to Bougie, the call we landed at. And I was on duty at the time from 8 o'clock till 12. It was a rainy, very dark night and raining. And the captain was on the bridge, and he said to me, he was on the starboard side of the bridge, and he said, there's been an Italian aircraft looking for us. Well, this plane come over, and there's a searchlight in his belly looking down at us. He said, this is it, here, he said to me. I said, aye. And but he never twigged us, all our lights out. Now, there was a funny thing. Well, I was in the Medi before that, before we get ready to land. One night was a pitch dark night last night, and we put the boats around divots outside, ready to launch them, in case you had to abandon ship. And I was on this side, the starboard side, on this Marlin machine gun. And all of a sudden, out of the darkness, come under the ship, and he grazed us, he took all our lifeboats where it is as well, that side. And the first mate was on duty that night, when I was on. Hoy there, shouted, what ship are you? And an English voice shouted, well, I imagine what the language he used, get effed. I always remember that incident.